We'll call administrative rules meeting to order and do the roll call.
Representative Lynn.
Here.
Banning.
Here.
Boshi.
Here.
Bernstock.
Here.
Koppelman. Ben.
Ben is not here.
Okay. Kim.
Here.
Owens. Do I have the wrong?
I think you have the wrong one.
I have the wrong sheet.
Yes.
Yeah, we didn't get the new sheet in here.
That's the last interim?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Use the agenda.
Okay. Okay, we'll go back through these again. Okay. Lauzer.
Here.
Mooney.
Here.
Schatz.
Here.
Schneider.
Here.
Silbernagle.
Here.
Sukut.
Here.
Thorson. Toman.
Here.
Weiss. Senators Armstrong. Davison.
Here.
Klein.
Here.
And Triplett.
Here.
Mr. Chairman, we have a quorum.
Thank you. Consideration of the minutes from the June 10th meeting. What are your wishes?
Move to approve.
Move by.
Second.
Is there a second, Pete?
Okay.
Moved by Senator Klein, second by Representative Silbernagle. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carried. Welcome you to the Administrative Rules Committee. Some of you are new, first time on here. We appreciate you joining us. Most of us have been on here our entire legislative careers. We're awful close to that, and we've enjoyed it. Hopefully you all volunteered, but if any of you were drafted by leadership in your particular party, we welcome you anyway. I think you'll enjoy it. We provide the defensive stand sometimes between state agencies and what they think they can do under the laws we have passed and what they would like to do sometimes. So you will enjoy it. I'll have Vanette do some supplementary rules, or John, I'm not sure who's doing that.
I got it. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The first document I'm going to go through very briefly is the supplementary rules of procedure for the North Dakota Legislative Management. You should have a copy of those in the information in front of you. Chances are, if you've already had a meeting this interim, you've already had these rules before you. I'm going to hit a few of the highlights, some of the issues that usually arise in committees. I'll point out on the first page, regarding attendance at a meeting, we always get a question of whether you can attend by teleconference or video. The rule on that is that can be done if it's been announced in advance and all committee members have that opportunity to participate in that by that medium. Something new, and if you look at 2G in that first column, staff shall encourage presenters to submit an electronic version of testimony in advance of the meeting. In the past, we've done that. It hasn't been part of our rules. We are doing that now. We're encouraging our presenters, and I was very grateful that a number of the presenters got that testimony to me in advance of the meeting today, and it has been linked on the agenda online that went on there last night, as well as this memorandum and the background memorandum that you have before you. So you have the opportunity to view the testimony in advance of the meeting. A couple other issues I'll point out. No expansion of committee duty beyond what was contemplated in a study resolution or what is assigned to the committee by statute. We usually get questions about bill drafts. No bill draft other than one drafted by the Legislative Council staff may be approved by legislative for recommendation to legislative management unless it's considered by the committee at least two meeting days, including consideration of revised drafts. That's under 3C. Another issue that sometimes arises is subcommittees. Those subcommittees of this committee may be appointed without the approval of the legislative management chairman. Some of the issue the rules on the back deal with the operation of the committee. There will be legislative council staff, which is what I am, will be staffing this meeting, or this committee. We have a director in the office, as well as staff that work to do the work behind the scenes for the committee for upcoming meetings. At the end of the interim, there will be a report prepared by myself and the chairman that will be presented to the legislative management in November of 2016. And that will be, you know, summarize the work of this committee up to that point. This committee is unique in that we meet quarterly, year-round, so our interim really never ends. It continues into December before session and March of the session, and then again June after the session. So a little bit unique from the regular interim committees. If there aren't any questions, I can go forward with the background memo.
Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, you may proceed.
Okay, thank you. The next document is the Administrative Rules Review Background Memorandum. This is a memorandum that was originally prepared by John Wolstead and has been fine-tuned over the years, and it's my go-to document. I'm fairly new to this. I just started with this committee about a year ago, and I find very, very valuable information in here. When I have questions, when I get questions from agencies, this is where I go, rather, you know, before I go to the statute, I'll see if it's been addressed in here. I won't read this, but I will go through quite a bit of it, especially for the new members of the committee. I think there's some really valuable information in here for you. The North Dakota Administrative Code, which is published by the Legislative Council Office pursuant to 2832-19, contains all the rules adopted by administrative agencies subject to the North Dakota Century Code Chapter 2832, which was referred to as the Administrative Agencies Practices Act. There are 124 titles in the code. 94 of those are rules of administrative agencies, and 16 agencies voluntarily publish their rules in the administrative code, although they're excluded from the definition of administrative agency. And I'll point that out later in the memorandum, the list of agencies that are excluded. Something that I've found valuable to point out to legislators is our numbering system. Administrative rules are a little bit different than the Century Code, with the administrative rules there are four divisions. If you have your supplement with you today, you'll notice on page 3, if you look at that section that's being amended, there are four divisions. It says 33, which is the title. 03 is considered the article. 24.1 is the chapter, and 23 is the section. That differs from the Century Code, where we have a title, a chapter, and a section. So we have one additional part in the administrative rules, which is the article. The statutory provisions for rule review is the next section of the memo. Since 1977, agencies were authorized to adopt administrative rules, but there was no central compilation for those rules. From 78 to 2005, administrative code supplements were published a month after the rules were filed with the Legislative Council for publication. Since 2005, those supplements have been published on a quarterly basis. And as you can see, the calendar for filing deadline and effective date are below. We are on the September 15th meeting deadline. We're at the deadline for that meeting. The filing date for this meeting was May 2nd to August 1st, and the rules will go into effect on October 1st for that are reviewed at this meeting. The next chart is a summary of the biennial periods since July of 79 on the number of sections of the administrative code that were amended, repealed, created, superseded, reserved, or designated during each identified time period. And turn the page, it goes all the way through the most recent biennial period of January 2013 to October of 2014. The committee also, the Legislative Council prepares a supplement containing all rule changes submitted for publication since the previous committee meeting. As you can see in this next chart is a biennial summary of the number of supplement pages that are contained in each of those biennial periods. The eight meetings are totaled up, and that's the total number of supplement pages. As you can see, we've been as high as over 4,000. The most recent biennial period was a little over 2,000. In 1979, the Legislative Assembly enacted statutes providing for a review of administrative rules. In 1995, that authority was expanded to allow this committee to void administrative rules on specific grounds. In 2005, a bill was enacted that would provide, except for emergency rules, administrative rules don't become effective until they've been reviewed by this committee. This committee is created by 54-35-2.5, which directs the legislative management to biennially appoint an administrative rules committee and to designate a chairman of the committee. The committee operates according to the statutes and procedures governing legislative management interim committees. As I mentioned, because this committee is created by statute, we're not discharged from duty when the legislative management report is submitted at the end of the interim, because we need to meet on a quarterly basis. I'll go through some of these sections that deal with specific sections of 2832 that give various authority to this committee. The first is objection to rules. In 2832-17 creates a procedure for the Administrative Rules Committee to object to rules if the committee finds the rule to be unreasonable, arbitrary, capricious, or beyond the authority delegated to the adopting agency. The next section deals with the voiding of rules. In 1995, the legislation was expanded to give this committee authority to review rules. 2832-18 allows the committee to find any or all portion of a rule void if the committee makes a specific finding, and those criteria are on the top of page 3. Absence of statutory authority, an emergency relating to public health, welfare, or safety, failure to comply with specific legislative intent, a conflict of state law, arbitrary and capricious, or failure to make a written record of its consideration or oral and written submissions respecting the rule during the hearing process and comment period. The section allows the committee to find a rule void if it's considered not later than the 15th day of the month before the date of publication. The committee can carry a rule over that's being considered, that a rule that they may have an issue with, to the next meeting. If no agency appears at that subsequent meeting, they're automatically held over for consideration. And if no one appears at that subsequent meeting, the rule is deemed void. If a rule is found to be void, the Legislative Council is to notify the adopting agency within 14 days, and the notice is sent to the chairman of the legislative management. The adopting agency can petition for review to the legislative management. If the legislative management does not act on that appeal within 60 days, the rule remains void. Go down to the rulemaking procedures on the bottom of page 3. 2832-01 subsection 2 defines what an administrative agency is. So you can see it's a board commission, department, or other administrative unit of the executive branch of state government. The list of agencies that are exempt from the administrative rulemaking process are listed on page four. As I mentioned, a number of those publish their rules in the administrative code, although they are not considered administrative agencies. Continuing on to page five, a rulemaking deadline. Once there is a statutory change that includes an amendment, creation, or repeal, the agency has 9 months to develop and adopt their administrative rules. If an agency needs additional time, they may request that time from this committee. Rulemaking notice is the process of providing notice to the public that rules are going to be considered and adopted. 2032-10 provides that a full and abbreviated notice must be made. The full notice is sent to the Legislative Council, where that notice is published on our website along with the proposed rules. Within that notice, the agency is to include whether it's expected to have regulated community in excess of $50,000, identify at least one location where the interested parties may review the text of the rule, provide the address where written comments may be sent, provide the deadline for written comments, telephone number, other information that the public would need if they want to make comments or support or oppose rules. Then an abbreviated notice has to be published in the county newspaper at least 20 days before the hearing. There's on the top of page six, there's a special notice requirement for the public superintendent of public instruction to statewide associations regarding certain education issues. A 2011 change provided for emergency rules. In the case of emergency rules, they're to notify persons who would be expected to have a substantial interest in those rules. And again, those are published on the Legislative Council website. The hearing process is in 2832-11, which a hearing is held for interested persons to submit testimony, data, arguments, either orally or in writing. There's a comment period of at least 10 days following the hearing. The next section is on emergency rulemaking, requires the approval of the governor to adopt rules that are needed because of imminent peril to public health, safety, welfare, or because a delay would cause a significant loss of revenue. The rule may be declared effective no earlier than the date of notice of filing with the Legislative Council. And it becomes ineffective if it's not adopted as the final rule within 180 days after the effective date. There's an Attorney General's review of all rules. The Attorney General looks for statutory authority, whether it's written in a manner that's concise and easily understandable, and and to determine that all procedures have been followed. Rule notice service. At one time, there was a notice service that was set up that subscribers could pay a fee and get notice of changes in administrative rules. With the availability of the RSS feed to receive rulemaking notices, there have not been any paid subscribers since January of 2013. Other information that's required to be included in the rulemaking process is a regulatory analysis, fiscal notes, whether there's an impact, a fiscal impact, whether there's an effect on small entities, whether there would be a constitutional takings, an assessment would be done. For the health department, there's some restrictions on air quality rules. Federal guidelines, 2832-04 prohibits agencies from adopting rules from federal guidelines that are not relevant to state regulatory programs. Force of law, and this has been mentioned in the discussion right before the meeting, administrative rules have the force and effect of law until they are amended or repealed by the agency, declared invalid by a court decision, suspended or found to be void by the Administrative Rules Committee, or determined by legislative council be repealed because the authority has been repealed or transferred to another agency. And then on finally on the last page, the guidelines under Century Code 203210 are attached as an appendix to your memo. And then the possible rule review during the 13-14 interim, the rules that were considered for review by each agency were asked to provide the information that's listed in the bullets 1 through 11. And an email is sent to agencies before every meeting asking them to provide this information in this format. And as you're probably aware, when you read through the testimony, that's followed quite closely. And Mr. Chairman, that concludes the memo.
Thank you, Renette. Are there any questions? Representative Koppelman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, I'm just curious about something that was referenced in the report you just gave, Vonette, and thank you for all the information. It's kind of voluminous, I know. This might be something that Mr. Wallstead knows, though, because it dealt with, I think a few years ago, it's at the top of page 6 where you refer to the 2011 change in House Bill 1162. And as I recall, the reason we did that is the State Board of Pharmacy and the Attorney General's Office were trying to keep on top of the, I guess what we'd call designer drugs. And we had laws against them, and every time we passed a law like that, they would change the chemistry, the formula a little bit, and all of a sudden our law didn't cover it. So the Board of Pharmacy adopted emergency rules to be sort of a catch-all. They later did that through statute, but they did it through rule as kind of a stopgap to try to stay ahead of this game. And a judge, as I recall, found that, basically threw that out because he said they didn't notify everyone. And everyone basically meant everyone in the state of North Dakota who could conceivably buy that product. And so that's, I think, why this bill came about, to say they have to notify the people that they can reasonably expect to be affected. How has that played out? John, have you heard of anything else in terms of courts interpreting that in a strange way, or has that kind of resolved that potential problem?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, in answer to Representative Kaufman's question, I think that change sort of clarified what is required. The court decision you referenced, humble opinion, was a terrible decision, and not something policy should be based on. But we have had some cases since then. There was an emergency bill in 2013 session that took effect, I believe, April 13. The governor signed it and filed it. A guy in Jamestown got arrested on the 12th, the day before the law took effect, so he was prosecuted under the rule. And I don't believe his attorney challenged, but he was convicted on the charge. And for some reason, I was dragged over there as a witness 3 times and sat there and never actually got in the courtroom. But anyway, I think that has now settled, and hopefully we don't have to see emergency rules on the designer drug stuff anymore. The statutes have now been changed to accommodate creative chemists.
Further questions? Seeing none, for the new committee members, I'm sure there will be a number of questions that come up as you go through this process. And, you know, what you're given today is a good reference, but, you know, feel free to call the chairman, feel free to call Vonette or John if you have questions. We're more than willing to help you through the process. So, Seeing none on that, we'll move to the 9:50 presentation from the Department of Health. Darlene, you, this was a, for new members, this was a rule that we held over last time at request of one of the members. Intent was to work with the health department to see if they could come up with language that was more acceptable to the people that objected to the rule the way it was written. Darlene, was you able to do that?
Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Yes, I was able to work with Representative Koppelman. Should I go ahead?
You may proceed.
My name is Darlene Bartz, and I'm the Health Resources Section Chief. I'm with the North Dakota Department of Health. At the June 10th Legislative Rules meeting, the request was made to revise subsection 6. And if you go to the rules handout that was given to you, it is actually on page 4 of the supplement that you are looking at, and is underlined. So we were asked to revise subsection 6 of the North Dakota Administrative Code to omit the names of residents who elected hospice when a basic care facility reports that they have a resident that elected hospice. I have worked with Representative Koppelman and John Walsted from Legislative Council on this, and also met with the Health Council members and proposed the following change in language. And so number 6 would read as the facility shall notify the department within 48 hours of the election that a resident has elected hospice, the date hospice was elected, and the name of the hospice agency serving that resident. So what we have done is deleted the need for them to report who that resident is to the department. And just to go on, the intent behind this change was to ensure the privacy of the individual who has elected hospice. Their privacy is also ensured both on the federal and state levels with the following requirements, which I've included there. The first set of requirements are part of the HIPAA requirements on a federal level, and those talk about the uses and disclosures for which an authorization is required. And as you can see, the general rule there, except as otherwise permitted or required by the subchapter, a covered entity may not use or disclose protected health care information without an authorization or that is valid under this section. When a covered entity obtains or receives a valid authorization for its use or disclosure of protected health information, such use or disclosure must be consistent with the authorization. And so there the resident would need to let us know that we can release that information. Otherwise, by federal law, we can't release that. So this federal requirement prohibits the release of protected health information, again, unless the individual authorizes it. There are some exceptions, and those exceptions in federal regulation include such things such as for treatment, payment, healthcare operation, public health, or healthcare oversight, which we would fall into those realms. So it is releasable to us under federal requirements. Then in North Dakota Century Code 23-01.302-02, disclosure of protected health information in general. This statute, let me just say, is part of the North Dakota Department of Health statutes. And this is what we refer to, in essence, as our little HIPAA laws internally to the health department. And it is in North Dakota Century Code. And what that states is that protected health information in possession of a public health authority, which we are, may be disclosed only as authorized by this chapter or another law of this state explicitly authorizing the disclosure of that information, except that the protected health information received or maintained under 23-01.1. And actually, that is the Healthcare Data Committee, may be disclosed only as authorized by this chapter. So unless there was a state law authorizing us to release the names of individuals who were in a basic care facility that had hospice were prohibited by this section of the North Dakota Century Code. So we really, by state statute, can't release that information.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, compliment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate Dr. Bartz's work on this, and I would move that the committee agree with this change suggested by the Department of Health.
Is there a second? Representative Sobenigle. Further discussion. This was kind of an interesting argument last time because it really told it over, passed by one vote, as I recall, because a good share of the committee felt this was all, the privacy was already protected under HIPAA, under federal law, and under state law. So we didn't know there was a need, but you feel, the department feels this change is needed, or you're just willing to go along with it?
Representative Devlin, I think that's a good question. I don't know that I felt it was necessary, but I'm more than happy to make the change. You know, I mean, that's fine either way. We really are charged with protecting people and protecting confidentially at all times. And really the reason that we need the information is that we're also charged in ensuring the health and the safety of the individuals. And when an individual is admitted or kept or maintained, let me just say, in a basic care facility and receiving hospice care, we're taking a social setting and we're allowing them to keep somebody who's requiring skilled nursing care that actually should be in a skilled nursing facility. And so we need to know that because there's added expectations as far as the care that these individuals are receiving because they are in a declining stage of life that ultimately will be skilled. And so it's just, it is an insurance of care. And like I said, you know, we're okay with this change. Do I think it's necessary? No.
Thank you. Mr. Ralston, I know you were involved with the discussions back and forth between the committee and the Department of Health. Is there anything more to add? Okay. Okay. Any further discussion? Senator Triplett.
Mr. Chairman and Dr. Bartz, I'll just go ahead and ask the opposite question then. Do you think that the department is losing anything by making this change in the sense of not being able to adequately protect the health and welfare of the people whose names are now not being provided to you?
Chairman Devlin, Senator Triplett, members of the committee, I think we're able to work around it as long as we get the dates that those people arrive into the, you know, elect the program and stuff like that. We're still going to collect that information because at that point in time, there's different things that need to take place at the facility, like they start needing to have like 40 hours of licensed nursing staffing. They need to be doing like e-scores, which is a mechanism that will determine how many staff are needed in case of fire to be able to evacuate that person. And so when we would do an on-site visit, you know, we would have some of that information and could check back to make sure that they are have provided those safeties. So I think we can make it work. Yeah.
Senator Klein.
Mr. Chairman and Darlene, you said you can make it work. Are we creating an additional burden then for your department to, I heard you say we can work around this, which often in my world means we have to spend extra energy to accomplish what we would have done anyway. Are you saying this isn't going to be an additional burden, but it's, you know where I'm going here? I just don't want somebody, staff, have to sit there and do an extra job when they should have been doing their other job anyway, and because we've created another burden.
And Chairman Devlin, our Senator Klein, and members of the committee, like I said, I think we can work around it just fine. And so, I mean, I'm okay with the amendments that we came up and would just recommend that we move forward with them at this point.
Further discussion? Representative Maine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman Berlin, this North Hospice and so forth, aren't the nursing, now who's reporting to you? Is it hospice or is it the nursing home that's reporting disinformation to you?
Chairman Devlin, Representative Boyne, members of the committee, basically we're requiring the basic care facility to report that information to us. We also would have access of that information through the hospice provider that would be caring for that resident. As you know, the regulatory authority within the health department, we license and certify the hospice entities for federal certification, and that becomes also a funding mechanism for hospice services that these individuals receive, and then we do also do the licensure for basic care. So we do have access in both realms.
Okay, if I can continue, Mr. Chairman, I guess with that, if there's someone in a nursing home that is in hospice, the nursing home should have all the records for that person, what they're there for, correct?
Yes.
So another basic, if they're in hospice, it really doesn't matter whether they're a hospice patient. They know what they're there for, whether it's what kind of treatment they're going to take. They're getting, I should say.
Representative Boyne, we basically have access to that information for all residents within the facility when we are on site doing that survey process, because what we need to do is we need to evaluate to make sure that their needs are being met and that they're getting the care and services that they need dependent on their health issues that are in the facility. We did wind up getting like an attorney general's opinion related to basic care and you know, to determine who was that responsible entity. And in essence, when they are in a basic care facility, which is different from a skilled nursing facility, they, by state statute, are required to meet all needs of those residents. So when there is like a hospice resident, even though they coordinate with a hospice entity, it is actually the basic care facility that is responsible for meeting the needs of those residents, and even when that resident's health care status declines to the point of death.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I can continue.
Let me continue.
So basically, the reporting that this is here really isn't really needed because it's all being taken care of by the nursing facility then?
Chairman Devlin, Representative Boyne, it is needed in that the care that they're providing in their facility at the date that person elects hospice does change, because instead of just providing that social setting of care, then they've indicated that, you know, we're willing to take on the responsibility of caring for a person who needs a higher level of care than we're licensed to provide. And so then they're, you know, caring for somebody who has skilled needs, who is in a declining status. So there is a very significant importance to us receiving that information at that point in time.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Further questions? Seeing none, we'll pull the committee on the motion from Representative Koppelman to approve the change that was worked out between the department and Representative Koppelman.
Representative Devlin?
No.
Boehner?
Yes.
Boshi?
Yes.
Ramsdok? Koppelman?
Yes.
Schatz?
Yes.
Silbernagel?
Yes.
Tolman?
Yes.
Sukit?
Yes.
Schneider?
Yes.
Mooney?
Yes.
Did I miss any representatives? Okay, Lauser. Thank you. Trying to update this. Okay, Senators Davison?
No.
Klein?
No.
Triplett?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, the motion carries.
The motion is carried. Thank you, Darlene. Representative Koppelman, thank you.
Yes.
We'll move on to the Insurance Commissioner's report. Somebody's here from the Insurance Commission. copies have been distributed.
All right. Good morning.
Good morning.
Chairman Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Johnny Paulsgraf, or actually Johannes Paulsgraf, but you can call me Johnny. I'm legal counsel for the North Dakota Insurance Department. Administrative Rule 450408 deals with allowing insurance companies to update the life expectancy tables, also known as mortality tables, that companies use when filing annuity insurance products with the department, the insurance department. Every few years, the Society of Actuaries, which is a nonprofit professional organization, they develop and release updated mortality tables to reflect the changes in life expectancies. When life expectancies change, insurance companies selling life insurance and annuities, they use the updated tables because it allows these companies to calculate the appropriate monetary reserves that back each insurance policy. In other words, updated tables allow insurance companies to right-size their company reserves in an amount that's set aside for the claims by the insurance. The department respectfully submits to you the required memo that was just passed out answering the questions on Rule 450408. To briefly summarize a few points, notice was published in all county newspapers. A public hearing notice was sent on March 19th, and a public hearing was held on April 30th, 2015. No oral or written comments were received, and there was no opposition to the rule. The small entity economic impact expected as a result of this rule is that companies will be holding more in reserve for their annuity policies. State and there's no expected state fiscal impact as a result of this rule, and no constitutional taking as expected to occur as this rule, not dealing with private property. Thank you, Chairman Dolan, and members of the Administrative Committee for an opportunity to speak before you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Are there questions from the committee? Representative Schneider.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Johnny, when do we expect these tables to be updated again, since they appear to be almost 4 years old now?
The history is not exactly set on how often the Society of Actuaries does update the tables. The last update was in 1999. This one, 2012, was the date that they updated the tables. However, it takes a while before states and companies start desiring to use these new tables. So I would expect based on the history, it'll be relatively the same, between 5 and 10 years before they're updated again.
Further questions? Senator Triplett.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Paulsgraf, can you just tell those of us who aren't really good at math how much longer we're all going to be living now according to these tables?
I would have to get an actuary to give you that information, but to answer the question, you'll live longer. That's a general answer.
Mr. Chairman, if I may continue.
You may continue.
It's sort of a facetious question, but when I hear you say that the rule will have no impact on the state, obviously the rule itself won't have any impact, but the fact that we're living longer as a society has enormous implications for state policymaking in terms of, you know, where we put our resources, you know, in terms of having an aging population. And so I think it actually would be of some use to us as legislators, and maybe this isn't the right time or place, but to understand generally, you know, how baby boomers passing through old age is going to impact the state and the nation in terms of healthcare costs and all the rest of it is an enormously important question, and I don't really expect you to answer it today, but I just thought maybe you could give us some idea of what you see as the impact here.
I agree with what you're saying, and that's something, of course, the insurance department deals with in many types of insurance, as well as health insurance, long-term care insurance, and these annuity products. With the rule that we're putting, the rule that we're discussing today, it's more of a wash between what happens, because as you know, if you buy life insurance or an annuity product at a young age, you pay less for that because over time you will pay more in the long run. If you buy it in your 80s, you pay more up front because you're going to get a larger return in a shorter amount of time. The way that the annuity tables work, it is the same concept of adopting these new tables. People will pay initially more, but then again, because they're living longer, they will recoup benefits into their later years. Thank you.
Further question, Representative Silverhagen.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Palsgraf, is this administrative rule of change in some way impacting larger companies more so than some of the smaller mutuals? I've received a little feedback from some folks in my district about some of the administrative rules in the past that have impacted them in a negative way, if you will, and that it's making it a little more challenging for them to conduct their business. Have you received any feedback related to these rules in that regard?
Chairman Devlin, Representatives Silbernagel, all right, thank you. Palsgraf, that's always a tough one. And we at the insurance department, we didn't expect any comments, and we do get comments from smaller companies, and the department is mindful of those smaller companies, especially, you know, the North Dakota companies that have to take impact by an administrative rule. In this particular instance, we didn't expect any comments because this is an industry standard that goes from small companies to large companies. All companies are required to use the form after a certain date, October 1st, 2015. And what, as I was clumsily expressing before, the companies just will hold more money in reserve for each policy that they are taking premium on. But that is a reflection of the amount that someone would be paying for that premium, and then in the long run, the amount that they would be getting back because they live longer. So we didn't get any comments from small entities on this particular rule, and we didn't really expect to because we didn't anticipate that they would be disadvantaged from a larger company. You're welcome.
Any further questions? Senator Klein.
Mr. Chairman, and you, Hans. you didn't get any comments from anybody. Did I read this correctly?
That is...
No comments, no written comments. What we're doing here is just adjusting the mortality table as we're living longer.
Exactly.
Outliving our income as we get really old.
Exactly. Representative Devlin, Senator Klein, that's a good way to sum it up. This is really just, this has occurred multiple times. Every 10 or so years this happens. It is, like you say, just because we are living longer, and that allows the companies to right-size their reserves to anticipate the longer lives of people collecting on these annuities.
Seeing no further questions, committee, this particular one has a couple of typos that are from Legislative Council. I believe they were submitted correctly. We're just typed wrong. And Vinette, you want to report them just saying correct their booklet?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 11, there are two instances where the decimal point is out of place. I believe it's been corrected in our database, but your paper copies will appear incorrectly. On the line that begins with, for example, for a male age 30, the number at the end should be .741, not 07.41. And then again, on the second to the last line, the number says equals 07.27, that should say 0.727. So decimal point is off by one place in each of those, and we will correct that.
Yeah. Was that bothering your senator at all? He thought, yeah, okay.
I didn't see well.
Okay, thank you. Seeing that, no further on that one, we will move on to the Real Estate Commission.
Good morning, Administrative Rules Committee members and Chairman Devlin. My name is Pat Jurgensen. I'm the Executive Director for the North Dakota Real Estate Commission, and I'm here to discuss our proposed administrative rule changes. In my testimony, you can see that our agency is solely responsible for the administration of the North Dakota Real Estate License Law and Administrative Code governing the conduct of real estate licensees. The Commission does not receive any federal or state funding to maintain our agency. Two of the rule changes adopted by the North Dakota Real Estate Commission are the result of the 64th Legislative Assembly. North Dakota Century Code 43-23-13.1 was amended to change the real estate license renewal application deadline to a date set by the Commission. Administrative Rules Section 7002.01.04 on page 15 and Section 7002.04.02 on page 22 were adopted in accordance with this statute. The remaining proposed changes are items that we wanted to add clarification to in the current administrative rules. You can see we answered the questions that Ms. Richter laid out before. If you want me to go through those, we did provide advance notice of the rules hearing in our spring 2015 issue of the North Dakota Real Estate News and Views, our official publication. It was mailed to each person who holds a license in a real estate license in the state of North Dakota. We also served notice on the public through publication of the hearing notice in each of the state's county newspapers as directed. A public hearing was held on May 7th, 2015 at 1 p.m. Central Daylight Time. Present at that meeting was Jill Beck, CEO for the North Dakota Association of Realtors. She spoke in favor of the proposed rule changes. The Commission received a letter from Richard D. Geigel, who has a broker's license in the state of North Dakota, stating that he was concerned that with the new November 15th license renewal date, and since errors and emissions insurance applications typically have not been mailed out until the first week in November, that errors and emissions insurance coverage will not be available to all licensees until December. In acknowledgement, I called Mr. Geigel and assured him that the Commission office was working closely with Rice Insurance Company, which is the provider that we are preferred provider, to ensure that the applications for errors and emissions insurance are mailed out early. Mr. Geigel then stated he was comfortable with the fact that we had taken care of that and had addressed his concern. The approximate cost for legal fees, including research, preparation, and appearance at the public hearing, was $320. The cost for printing and mailing the notice to all licensees was $2,767.41. The publication in the local newspapers was $1,949.58, for an approximate total of $5,036.99. The rules hearing was held in conjunction with a regularly scheduled, or with a scheduled commission meeting, so there were no additional costs, meals, lodging, travel, or per diem for the commissioners to attend that hearing. There was no regulatory analysis required, no economic impact statement was required, a fiscal note was not required, there are no constitutional takings assessment prepared, and these are not emergency rules. Okay. Section 7002.0104 is located on page 15. The amendment to this rule sets a license renewal deadline date referred to in the revised statute 4323.13.1 as November 15th of each year in order for licenses to be renewed on a timely basis for the following license period. The next sentence, which reads, failing to do this subjects such persons to loss of the right to charge a commission and also prosecution for doing business without a license, was amended by adding after December 31st at the end of the sentence for clarification, because real estate licenses run January 1 to December 31st. We are just asking that the renewals be turned in by November 15th first, so we can get them all processed and everyone legally licensed by January 1st. On page 3 of my testimony, section 70201-06, 1, 3, and 4 is located on page 15 through 16. The amendments to this rule clarify the licensing requirements for real estate licensees from other states to receive a non-resident or reciprocal North Dakota real estate license. Section 70.02.01-15.2 and D is located on page 18. The purpose of this amendment is to add reference to the abandoned property statute to provide our brokers with the proper procedure to be used when unclaimed earnest money remains in their trust account for 3 years or more. Section 70.02.02.10 is located on page 20. The wording of this rule was revised to be in concert with Administrative Rule 70.02.04-14, maximum hours of accreditation per day, which states that no more than 8 hours of education can be taken in one day. Section 70.02.03 is located on page 21. The amendment to this rule clarifies the guidelines under which an out-of-state broker can be paid a commission. Section 70.02.04.02 is located on page 22. The amendment to this rule sets a continuing education time frame to correspond with revised statute 4323.13.1 and amended rule section 70.02.01.04, setting the renewal date deadline as November 15th of each year. This rule changes the education cycle required for continuing education for real estate licensees to coincide with that, so it would be November 16th to November 15th of the following year. Section 70.02.04-14 is also located on page 22. The purpose of amending this rule is to clearly state what types of education must adhere to the maximum of 8 hours of education a day to receive accreditation for taking the course. I'll be glad to answer any questions that you may have.
Questions from the committee? Representative Hauser.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Pat. I guess for the committee, I need to make a couple disclosures. My mother is one of the five real estate commissioners in North Dakota, and my reference is going to be to the abandoned property, as Pat is probably what I was going to talk about. I've been licensed in North Dakota since 1997, and about 10 years ago, the Real Estate Commission increased the license fees to allow for audits of brokers. And every 2 years now, every broker in North Dakota gets audited. In 2013, I had an audit and specifically referenced the abandoned property and to turn over the old trust account deposits that I had in my account to the Unclaimed Property Division. When I asked the commission how to do that, I wasn't given any direction on how to do it. So I proceeded with the Unclaimed Property Division in the state. And when I talked to them, they said they had not ever received, up to that point, any trust account deposits, and they weren't familiar with how to proceed. Ultimately, I provided a remedy, contacted the parties that may have been affected, and then requested a hearing with the commission and refuted the claim. And
and went before an administrative law judge, and I believe to this point I'm the only broker that's done that with the commission. When I prepared for that hearing, I researched the legislative intent of unclaimed property and found that this was created in the 70s and then discussed in the legislature in the 80s and the 90s, and it referenced numerous financial instruments such as traveler's checks, unissued or uncashed checks, money orders, and things like that, but never referenced real estate trust deposits. Ultimately, when I went before the commission, they found that I had, I guess, substantially made my case, but they did give me a letter saying that I didn't respond soon enough to a previous audit in 2011. So I guess a couple questions that I would have is the unclaimed property division, are they supportive of this rules change, or would it be better that they maybe propose a bill and to put it in the century called to reference real estate trust accounts?
Chairman Devlin, Chairman Devlin, Representative Lauzer. My understanding is that, and I don't have the law in front of me, so I may be speaking inappropriately, but my understanding is that the current unclaimed property disclosure or unclaimed property rules do cover trust accounts, money held in trust. And so we've moved forward. This has gone before the Attorney General's office as well and has been approved. So we're moving forward with that process.
Let me continue. From what I can tell, there are specific references in the century code to life insurance, security deposits, traveler's checks, stocks, wages, safe deposit boxes, even mineral proceeds. There isn't anything that references trust accounts, but it does reference outstanding checks, but the checks in this case would have been cashed. So my position was always it wasn't unclaimed. It was claimed by more than one party. Otherwise, I wouldn't be holding the check. So I'm not certain that I read it the same way. But changing the rules would now allow the commission to enforce the abandoned property portion of the century code. If I understand, that's what we're doing here, is allowing the commission to enforce abandoned property rules. Is that correct?
Chairman Devlin, Representative Lauzer, I don't believe that's the intent of that. The intent was to provide clarification because we already thought that it's no different than requiring if a real estate firm is coming to our office for licensing, if they're using a trade name, we verify that they have registered it with the Secretary of State's office. In my mind, this is the same thing. It's already a state law, and we're just a follow through to make sure that's done properly with our licensees during the time of audit.
If I may continue, we're referencing 3 years here. I'm still unclear when the 3 year starts, when it begins. Is it a calendar year? Is it time of the deposit? Is it when the offer to purchase failed? Do we have clarification on that?
Chairman Devlin, Representative Lauzer, I believe that the auditors use the date that is deposited, the date of the purchase agreement, where the money is taken, when the money is accepted. I could verify that if you have questions.
I think that should be clarified for brokers, practitioners, and consumers who write a check should know if their money is being held in the trust account, when it must be turned over to unclaimed property. I guess one more question. The real estate commission has fined brokers up to this point for failing to turn this over to unclaimed property up to this point, correct?
Chairman Devlin, Representative Lauzer, what happens when our trust account auditors go out and conduct an audit is that they have a sheet and of items that they verify are done within this law. The first time that they discover that there is money that is in a trust account that's been held there for more than 3 years, that they sit down with the broker. They always go over the audit, the results of the audit with the broker. The broker signs off, and then I follow up with a letter and say, you know, it shows, not verbatim, but it shows that you have money in your trust account that's more than 3 years old. Please take care of it. Okay? 2 years later, they, as Representative Lauzer said, our auditors audit trust accounts and brokers' files every 2 years. At any time, once that first time, that notice is there, they will go out, and if they find it again, they will be written up again for having money in their trust account that is over 3 years old. The letter will again go out from me stating that they need to turn that money over to unclaimed properties. Sometimes we put a date in there, sometimes we don't. We've learned now we need to put a date in there and have people respond back to us as it's been taken care of. The third time it happens, if that money still has not been taken care of or it continues to be an issue, we call it a recurring issue, that's when it goes in front of the commission as a report and a complaint is filed. Representative Wells is the one that's gone all the way through to the complaint process at this point. There are other brokers, understandably, that have been written up for it, but they've taken care of the situation.
Well, I guess my question is, have other brokers been fined for violation of this rule?
Chairman Devlin, Representative Wells, or no?
I'm going to take a couple questions from Senator Triplett.
Chairman Devlin and Ms. Last Your Name, I'm sorry.
That's fine.
Okay, Pat. Jurgensen, Nick, came back from UK. Thank you. Listening to this conversation between yourself and Representative Walzer, it sounds to me almost like you're talking about two different things. I think I heard him referencing the fact that money is being held in his trust account because two or more parties are claiming it, not because it's been abandoned by anyone. And it seems to me that if there's a situation where two or more parties are claiming it and he doesn't know to whom to send the money, that maybe it would be more appropriately deposited with the district court, for example, than with the unclaimed properties fund, because to send it to the unclaimed properties fund is for him to be making a decision about which of the two parties it belongs to. So, I guess the question is this really abandoned funds we're talking about, or are you sometimes forcing the transfer to the abandoned property fund of funds that really are in dispute as to the ownership?
Okay. Chairman Devlin and Senator Triplett, if I'm understanding your question correctly, that money may have been has been sitting in the account for 3 years. My understanding, and I'm not an authority on the unclaimed property and the process there, so I want to say that. I do know that before the money is turned over to unclaimed property, that the person who is holding that money has to show unclaimed property that they've made an effort to reach out to the people involved. Sometimes this money that's held in a trust account, either the people, the buyer and the seller, when the transaction didn't close, can't agree who wants the money. Their option is to go they can go to court for it. But it's the real estate agent, the brokerage is a keeper of the money. That's why they're, in a way, it's sort of like a good thing for them to be able, after 3 years, to get rid of it, because it's not their responsibility anymore to hold that money. But we've been told through our auditors that their view, their opinion of what the unclaimed property is, that money is, the money goes to unclaimed property, and then unclaimed property takes care of it from there.
I'm sure I'm not understanding this properly, but to me it looks like you're writing rules to fine somebody or whatever the case may be for something that you're already doing. You're writing rules after the fact, and I'm troubled by that. And am I not understanding that correctly? Or have you been fining people up to now without the rules that you're proposing now? Or what am I missing?
Chairman Devlin and the committee, when our auditors go out and they find that money, that there has been earnest money put down, earnest money in a broker's trust account for over 3 years, their opinion is that fits under the unclaimed property rule, which the rule, in our understanding, requires the broker or anyone who has money in like that. That's, well, I'll just deal with real estate, with the broker, to turn the money over to unclaimed property for it to be worked through that process there. So yes, brokers have gotten written up for it. I saw your face when I said you maybe were the only one, thought you, I know you got a letter of reprimand. I don't know if, we may have fines, I don't have that information with me, so I want to clear that up, because I've been doing this for 12 years and I can't remember, I wasn't prepared with the history. But what we're really doing is just trying to clarify, because we already felt that our rules said that, but when Representative Lowndes' situation came up, we felt that it needed to be clarified in the rule, in that particular rule, that the trust account, that money should be turned over properly to unclaimed properties. It was just a clarification and a reaction to his situation. So that's what we view it as. It's not like a new rule, it's just a clarification of something we're already doing. Does that make sense?
It probably makes sense to you. I don't know if I agree with what you're saying. And I share Senator Triplett's concerns over the abandoned property. I did not see that covering this type of thing at all, but, you know, I could very well wrong. Perhaps Representative Koppelman or Senator Davidson or one of the others ones that might have dealt with this in committee would have a better feel for that, but... Representative Koppelman?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know what I can answer that, but I do have a question sort of relating to the one you asked and that and to the answer that Mr. Jurgensen gave. If, now you said you've been doing this under your pre-existing rule, so is there a rule somewhere that does specifically address money going to the Unclaimed Property Division? I mean, I see that here as new rule. So what rule are you referring to? Is this just a procedure that you have that you're depending on, relying upon, or...
Chairman Devlin and Representative Koppelman, yes, it would be. It's an interpretation, and this was to clarify. It's not, so it would be then, I guess, a new rule, in addition to the rule.
If I could may continue, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Thank you. Well, I think, you know, what I'm hearing, as I've been listening, is as much as the chairman said, and as I'm beginning to, I think, understand this a little bit, probably innocently and with good intention, but it sounds like the commission came to the conclusion that if there's money sitting there for longer than a certain period of time, it should go to the Unclaimed Property Division because that's where unclaimed money goes, just as kind of this general idea. Representative Lauser pointed out that apparently the statute, which I haven't referenced here or looked at, but apparently that doesn't deal with this particular type of account or money, whereas other unclaimed money in the state, some of it does fall into that category. And you've maybe just assumed that, well, it's kind of a Me Too thing. Well, if we have money sitting there, that's where it ought to go. Again, that's probably a logical assumption, but when you start fining or reprimanding people over it, you might not have authority to do that without this. So I understand why you're coming here. The question we have, I guess, is do we do this and sweep you into that arena without any statutory underpinning to do that? And that's really the question. Am I understanding it correctly?
Chairman Devlin and Representative Koppelman, I believe that you are, and of course this is the one time I think I can handle it, and I told our attorney not to come. So I don't feel that I'm doing justice to this discussion. Obviously our attorney represented the Real Estate Commission in Mr. Lauser's situation, and we didn't come to a meeting of the minds. And the commission and with our attorneys, her due diligence in doing her job, this is the suggestion. So I'm sorry, I really can't, don't know what else to tell you.
Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Jurgensen, one of the options, I don't know how familiar you are with the work of this committee, but one of the options would be that we, I mean, if none of the rest of the rule is objectionable to anyone, I guess we could just take that section and hold it over for consideration until our next meeting, and then you could bring your attorney in to talk to us if you want to do that. I mean, that's certainly an option.
Chairman Devlin and Representative, I have no problem with that. I want to make sure that everyone's on the same page when we go through this. It's not a dire emergency. We were doing administrative rule amendments, and we just wanted to get some issues taken care of that were pending. So.
Representative Lauser.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to be clear. I don't want to hold trust account money in our trust account beyond a certain time either, because it's just something that the broker has to manage. In reference to Senator Triplett, the broker can't turn the check over or the money over to the court unless somebody's initiated a court action to attach to a file number or a case number, so that the court wouldn't accept it unless they have something to attach it to. So one of the parties has to start a court action for that to happen. Oftentimes, the offer to purchase says as soon as that happens, the money goes to the court. But these are in issues where that hasn't happened yet. What I would hope to see is clarification of the three-year, when that begins and ends, and going back to any broker that has paid a fine previous to this rule change, I think should be refunded the fine. I was not one of those, but I believe there are brokers that have paid a fine and just moved on. And short of this rule being in place at the time of the fine, I think the commission may want to consider refunding those fines. Those are the two issues that I would have.
Representative Koppelman, if you want to answer a question, I don't see this as abandoned property, but maybe I'm not understanding right. I'm assuming it's in a trust account because all sides or one of the parties or someone is saying we're not ready to settle or whatever. That's why it's sitting there. It isn't abandoned.
I think he means Representative Lauser.
Excuse me, Representative Lauser, I'm sorry. I'm assuming that that's what's happening. Maybe I'm wrong. I mean, is there money sitting in a trust account that nobody cares about, so to speak, that nobody, you're not hearing anything from anybody? Or what's the situation there?
Well, Mr. Chairman, there are thousands and thousands of transactions across the state every year. We're not referencing all of the ones that close or that are resolved. So you'll either have a transaction where there's a deposit, and the deposit gets credited to the buyer closing, and the money goes out. What we call in the legislature good funds, everybody may recall that. That goes to the closing agent, and the money gets credited to the buyer and it closes. In a transaction that fails, the buyer and seller may negotiate that fee, or they may take it to court. And in both cases, the broker has some resolution to say, here's where the money goes. What we're talking about here is an instance where nobody has taken any action. The transaction didn't close. The money's sitting in the broker's account. Nobody has started a court proceeding. Nobody has negotiated the settlement. And nobody's taken any action, so we're holding the funds. So in my mind, it wasn't abandoned, and it wasn't unclaimed. It was claimed by more than one party, because I wouldn't be holding it otherwise. And I don't have the authority to make the decision to say one of the parties gets the check, as Senator Triplett mentioned.
Well, not, other than not having your name right, that was the way I understood it. So I was just, you know, I was worried if I was completely missing it here. So Representative Koppelman has obviously proposed a solution that the committee should look at, but is there more involved than this one section, or are your concerns really with this one section?
Mr. Chairman, just the one section, the clarification of when the 3 years begins.
Okay.
And what the commission might consider doing for any fines up to this point. There is an alternative way to handle this, and that is to put wording in standard offers to purchase, although we don't have that in North Dakota. Each local municipality has their standard offer to purchase that would direct, after a certain period of time, that the broker holding the money do something. And one of those solutions would be, if it's not resolved in a 90-day window or 120-day window, that the offer to purchase would immediately dictate that the funds go to the buyer. But there is no standard offer to purchase in North Dakota. Each municipality has their own.
Is there further questions, Representative Koppelman?
Mr. Chairman, I have an unrelated question. Did you mention Senator Davidson had something there?
No. Representative Daney, did you have a question before? Okay. That's where it was. Sorry.
Okay. Thank you, Pat. You'd addressed the insurance company. How is that going on? Have they come to an agreement to get this stuff all out? Did they send anything in writing on this, or is it still kind of a limbo?
Chairman Devlin and Representative Daney, yes, everything has been sent out as of September 1st. We've worked closely with the insurance company, and so they've had it. Agents, all the licensees have had the information they'll have had it for 2.5 months before the deadline. So.
Okay, and just one follow-up on that, Mr. Chairman, if I may. One of the other things, I think this is new language, new law this year where we setting up the license sooner. Has there been any problems with
getting all this stuff out to all the realtors in the state so they get their licensing done, their accreditation, all their, I should say not accreditation, but their updates for their, what do I call it, ST what?
Continuing education.
There you go. Has that been an issue with any of them, or is it going to be right at the deadline, everybody has to have it done, or are you going to allow any, you know, people get busy in the summer, you know, Fargo, the realist, you know, they're busy and busy, and so is this going to be a problem putting this rule into effect, being the law was just passed this last year?
Chairman Devlin and Representative Bain, we worked believing that this rule would be approved, so everything, I have gone around the state, spoken to several boards across the state at their general membership luncheons. We've sent out blast emails to all of our licensees once a month for the last 3 months, and we continue to do so. They've all been mailed the information. It's on our website. Aside from calling everyone up personally, we really believe we've gotten it, the information out. And also when we, this law, when we were going through legislative process, we kept people up on what was going and what the plan was going to be, because we had worked closely with the insurance companies, also with the providers of continuing education. We had notified them that this would be, that we foresaw that this was what was going to happen. And so we will always have those people that wait until midnight, November 14th, to do their education. They did it December 31st, which was why we felt this was important to keep everybody, to get everybody's licenses processed and have them ready to go by January 1.
Okay. President Kaplan, I'll move you to either a question or a motion or both.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I do have a question that's unrelated to what we've been discussing, but on the top of page 16, and I realize this is probably not a substantive change in the rule, but it has to do with reciprocity and reciprocal licenses from other states and so on. And I'm just curious in that concept in general, because our committee has dealt with reciprocity of licensing in various areas, educators and other professionals and so on. And we kind of encourage that when possible. Appraisers come to mind. How does that work with realtors, real estate agents? Is it easy to do? Is it something that we embrace? Or is it a big hurdle to be licensed in North Dakota reciprocally if you're licensed in a neighboring state or another state?
Chairman Devlin and Representative Kaufman, well, we have two types of licensing available. We have reciprocal, which means that an agent who has in their company who has a license, say, with Minnesota, we have reciprocity. That means that they do the application process, fingerprinting and all that. The only thing they don't have to do is take the exam, the license exam. We only have reciprocity, honestly, with three states. Not that we have gone around and taken them away. Most states have rescinded their reciprocal agreements because the belief is that when a licensee from another state comes to North Dakota, that they should know our state law. And so then they become a non-resident licensee, and the requirement then is they only take the state portion of the law exam, the state portion of the exam, which is on North Dakota law. They don't have to retake the national portion or anything like that. So we are ensuring that they know the North Dakota law.
Mr. Alston.
Just returning to the trust account issue, the statutory provision, if you'll indulge me, in 4730.1, the general rule is, except as otherwise provided by this chapter, which of course means you got to read the whole chapter to make sure, but all intangible property, including any income or increment derived therefrom, less any lawful charges that is held, issued, or owing in the ordinary course of a holder's business and has remained unclaimed by the owner for more than 3 years, after it became payable or distributable, is presumed abandoned. That's the abandoned property law. So there is a point here where the three-year clock starts running when it's payable or distributable. Now that's questionable, and in the situation Representative Lauser described, if he doesn't know when it's payable or distributable, the three-year clock doesn't begin to tick. So the rule differs. differs a bit. It doesn't have that payable or distributable language, and it says deemed abandoned. The statute says presumed abandoned. A presumption is a pretty powerful word in law. Not sure if it differs from deemed, but the statute that is to be enforced here, the language doesn't quite mesh. So,
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and you know, having heard that, we can't obviously, we can enforce state law through rules,
right.
We can't reinterpret it or revise it, so I think it does need some work, and I would move that we hold that paragraph over until our next meeting for further consideration.
Second by Senator Triplett. Discussion? Seeing none, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carried. I would ask that you work with Representative Lauzer, probably Representative Koppelman and Mr. Lauzer. Lauzer and Mr. Walstead to see if we can come with language that is appropriate. Thank you.
We'll do that. Thank you very much.
No, we're not going to get to it. We have breaks scheduled. We haven't been here long. Would you like your break? Otherwise, I'm going to move into Department of Public Instructions. I don't see anybody racing for the door, so... okay, we'll take a quick 9.5 minute break.
Sorry about that, John. I didn't look over to see if you...
We have a representative superintendent of public instruction regarding the request of repeal of some codes. You may proceed. Do you have handouts or are they already around?
Mr. Chairman,
okay.
I believe you have all of the handouts.
Okay, got it.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Marthaler, Assistant Superintendent at the Department of Public Instruction. I believe it's on. Maybe it's my voice today. I'm a little bit fighting a little cold and some allergies, but... we're here today to ask for or to recommend repeal of Administrative Rule Chapter 67-1901, which has to do with the accreditation procedures, standards, and criteria. And we're making this recommendation based on North Dakota Century Code 28-32-18.1, which I believe allows us to expedite this process to a certain extent. I do have prepared testimony that I believe that you have, and I'll just refer to that. But during the 62nd North Dakota legislative session, in House Bill 1029, amended North Dakota Century Code 15.106-06. And these amendments now require school districts, in order to obtain approval certification, to submit to the North Dakota DPI a compliance report verifying that teachers meet licensure requirements, that curriculum requirements are met, as you would find in North Dakota Century Code 15.1-21, and that the school has been inspected by State Fire Marshal, that the district conducts background checks on all employees that have unsupervised contact with any children. And then also, and probably the most relevant part to the conversation today, is that all schools participate in a review process designed to increase student achievement through a continuous cycle of improvement. During that same session, and it was also in House Bill 1029, that North Dakota Century Code 15.127-08 and 09, which pertains to unaccredited schools, those sections were repealed. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, since the amendments in House Bill 1029 then removed many of the references to accreditation, making existing accreditation rules obsolete and actually established a process more towards school approval and away from accreditation. So based on the authority provided in North Dakota Century Code 15.1-02-11, the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction has established that all schools seeking accreditation, which virtually all schools in North Dakota are doing, to do so through the Advanced Ed Accrediting Regional Association, to go through the regional accreditation process, and that all schools will participate in the school improvement cycle of improvement as required by law. That determination was based on a recommendation made to the state superintendent, who agreed with the recommendation. I'll tell you just a little bit about the committee that worked on making that recommendation. The committee worked for, I'd say, upwards to a year. It was made up of many school administrators, teacher representative organizations. They took a look at actually a couple of questions. They studied, should North Dakota have accreditation rules at all? Should we use Advanced Ed or a process similar to Advanced Ed, or to rewrite our own new system of accreditation rules? And so the committee throughout the work did make the recommendation that the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction endorse and recommend for school accreditation the Advanced Ed process. Advanced Ed is a regional accrediting association. There are about 32,000 schools across the world. And so that's the process that we are following now. And I think that we are now in about the third year of that process. And we've waited to ask for the repeal so that we could fully implement the Advanced Ed process, which we are at now. The Advanced Ed process is for the most part paid by the state, approved by in the DPI budget, which you folks approve each year. So, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the adoption of the Advanced Ed model of accreditation, again, has rendered the current accreditation rules obsolete, and therefore we recommend that Administrative Rule Chapter 67-1901 be repealed, with one exception, which is in 67-19-06. There's one line in there that is amended because it refers to accreditation rules, and that section, I think it's on page 4 in the document that I believe you have, it refers, we still need that section because it's how we classify school districts, and so we need to keep that. But other than that, we're asking that the entire title be repealed. Mr. Chairman, I would also like to mention to members of the committee that we did, as part of the process required, we did make notification by email. I don't know if you have a copy of that, but we did email, or we sent notification via email to all of the representative organizations, including school superintendents, school principals, the North Dakota School Boards Association, the North Dakota Council of Educational Leaders, the BIE, BIA, everybody we could think of, special education directors. We notified all of the department staff, and I believe maybe it was also sent to North Dakota School Boards members, it was sent to the North Dakota School Boards Association. So, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, that essentially concludes my testimony, and again, we would recommend to the committee that to repeal that title. And I would try to answer any questions.
Are there any questions from the committee? Madam Schneider, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Berthel, do we currently operate unaccredited schools, and if so, how many in North Dakota?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I believe that there are no unaccredited schools. Many of them are beginning the process of advanced ed, and there's like a five-year cycle, but I don't believe there's any that are unaccredited.
Thank you. Reverend Schatz, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Bob, did you supply us with the new rules, this advanced ed, the new rules, what we're replacing here?
Representative Schatz, members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, no, because we are not adopting advanced ed as administrative rules. We've adopted the and recommended the advanced ed process through procedural and approval through budget authority that you folks have given us. We're not asking for administrative rule for advanced ed. There's no need for us to do that.
Okay, well, Mr. Chairman, may I continue? So I read through, you know, what you're getting rid of, and where do I find what you replaced it with?
Again, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we're not replacing the administrative rules, but I can certainly get you advanced ed details, description, the process that they go through. It's a five-year school, it's a five-year cycle. There's external and internal review. It's based essentially on standards and research of quality instruction, with the focus being on student performance. But I can provide anyone, actually, and I think you can actually go to the department website and access advanced ed in the process that's being followed.
Senator Triplett?
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Berthel, in your testimony, your written testimony, you described this as a regional accreditation process, and in your oral testimony, you referred to it, advanced ed, as having accredited 32,000 schools across the world. So that confused me a little bit. I mean, just is the region equal to the globe, or just to describe advanced ed and who they are and what they do?
Good question, Senator Triplett. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. No, the advanced ed is regionalized, and I believe there's like four or five regions. It is worldwide, but our region is separate and is accredited through advanced ed, but it is a regional, in that case, a regional process.
Let me continue. Just can you describe our region?
I don't have that information, Senator Triplett. I do have, though, a backup that might be able to answer more of the questions about advanced ed. And so you probably know Gwen Marbach, and she's the temporary or interim director of teacher and school effectiveness. She can probably answer that for you.
Thank you. Okay, for the record, my name is Gwen Marbach. I'm the interim director of teaching and school effectiveness. To first address the administrative rule on where did these go, where did some of this information go, they went into our North Dakota State Assurances. I can provide copies of those to you. There are 10 assurances that school districts need to assure that they are doing, and they are looked at and licenses, excuse me, they are done yearly. And they are, we at the department go through those and make sure those are done. Now, when you go to the, when you have the on-site visits, we are there to ensure not only does the advanced ed team assure that these are done, we go in and also look to be sure that they are done to our specifications. That is the first question. Now, the advanced ed is, first of all, a worldwide accreditation agency. They accredit schools, they accredit hospitals, they even accredit some businesses. Now, the region that we are in, I believe, has five states in it. And so when we talk about the region, all the regions are advanced ed, but we work with our specific regional advanced ed office. Does that answer some of your questions? Or does that just create more?
You may continue.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Marbeck?
Yes.
I'm still looking to know what the region is, so if you could tell me what states are in the region, and as a follow-up to that, what difference it makes to be in a region, if there's any distinction region by region in terms of how the accreditation is done, or if the region is just some kind of an administrative device for geographic proximity to schools.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Triplett, members of the committee, the region just specifies the states that are in the region. So, example, North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota, possibly Wyoming, Montana. Our regional director works with the advanced ed. She is the executive director of advanced ed. So when you ask what are the differences between regions, there are none. We just work with our particular region. And our director is resident here, and the offices are located in Bismarck. Does that answer your question?
Okay. Representative Franzweig.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Marbeck, as you go through the accreditation process, and you're looking at a school in Bismarck, and you're looking at schools in Minot, who is going to determine that what's being reviewed and what's being put on paper, I guess, is the same?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Franzweig. Okay. And members of the committee, I'm not sure I understand your question, but I'm going to answer it this way. When we go into, when the advanced ed team goes into the school, they are looking at their self-assessment. There are things that all schools need to do with accreditation, but it is individualized when it comes to what they need to do to improve school achievement. So that is, you know, the top part of it, this is what all schools need to do, that's looked at right away. In fact, that's looked at yearly. And so when the team goes in, they look at what the school's surveys tell them they need to do, what their data needs tells them what they need to do. And that is the direction in which they need to go. And what is asked in those sessions, and it's a three-day session with the schools, and depending on the size of the district, it's longer. What are your needs? How did you find out your needs? And how are you addressing your needs? What are your plans and goals? Those types of things. Does that answer your question?
You may continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, it does, because I think what you're telling us is that you're not actually going in and doing the assessment, you're reviewing the self-assessment.
Exactly.
That's what's happening all over.
Yeah, exactly. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and this is, there is a benchmark that schools need to meet, and that is advanced ed benchmarks. They're very rigorous. That's why advanced ed was chosen. They need to meet their needs, but they also need to meet the regulations and procedures of advanced ed with fidelity. So no one can go out and just, you know, say, we think we need to do this and we think we need to do that. They need to show proof of that. Okay, all right.
Representative Koppelman.
I
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have what might be a series of questions, if that's okay. I'm sorry, Gwen, I missed your last name.
Marbach, M-A-R-B-A-C-K.
Ms. Marbach, you've talked quite a bit about schools need to do this and they have to do that, and under what authority? What if they don't?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Copeland, members of the committee, right now it is mandatory under the state superintendent that all schools be accredited through Advanced Ed. And if they...
Thank you for interrupting. How is that mandated?
Seek accreditation, I'm sorry.
Is there a statute that mandates that?
Representative Copeland, Mr. Chairman, I don't know the answer to that.
Maybe Mr. Marthal is getting up so that he can...
Representative Copeland, yes, we believe that generally the state superintendent has the authority under... where's my schedule? I have it actually referenced, I think. I have it. Hold on, I do have it. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and Representative Copeland, we believe that under 15.1-02-11, the Superintendent of Public Instruction has the authority to establish rules and establish accreditation procedure. We believe that the State Superintendent, under general authority, may establish rules, establish procedure. Accreditation, for school districts may seek accreditation. They must be approved, but they may seek accreditation. Does that help answer your question?
Well, without reading that statute, probably not completely, but what it sounds like to me is that you are relying upon that to imply that the superintendent can ignore the administrative rules process, can create some kind of a standard that we're being, I mean, first time I've ever heard of this, maybe that's true of others, maybe others are intimately familiar, I don't know, just out of whole cloth, and you expect it to carry the same authority or force as the current system which you're asking us to repeal. Am I hearing that correctly?
Representative Copeland, members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, yes, I think that's accurate.
Well, you're aware, and I realize that, you know, for years DPI wasn't under the Administrative Practices Act, under the Administrative Rules Procedure, whereby you need to make rules, they need to come before this committee, and the committee has the appropriate authority over them and so on. My concern is, for your sake, that unless the rules come through that process, they don't carry the force and effect of law. So if a school district, in effect, decided to thumb its nose at you and say, I'm not going to jump through the hoops you've put forth, I don't know that you have the legal authority to force them to do that if it's just something you create in your office and say, I think we should do this. That's one issue. Secondly, I think you've been talking about this as if it's a already existing process. Am I hearing that correctly?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Copeland, yes. Schools, the state has been involved in participating in the funding of it for, I believe, two sessions, which has been in the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction's budget.
So has that been...
I'm sorry. Schools have been using, not all schools, but many schools in North Dakota have used, it was once called the North Central Accreditation System, have used it for years and years and years. NCA, the North Central Accrediting Association, has evolved into what is now called Advanced Ed. And so the process has been followed before. It was not, it has never essentially been mandated. And I think, Representative, that's where you're getting at.
Well, it is, and I don't know the process, so I'm not objecting to the process. It may be just fine. It may be a very good accreditation procedure and so on. My concern is more with process legally here.
I understand.
And you know, the reason I believe that the legislature made it mandatory for the Department of Public Instruction to be a part of the Administrative Practices Act, including, heeding its parameters with respect to making administrative rules, is because we fully expect that if the department promulgates rules, if the department carries out its tasks, its charge, and promulgates rules to do that, that it would do what every other agency, what every other elected, constitutionally elected official does. You know, the Attorney General doesn't just go off and say, I think we're going to do this. We make laws and he enforces them. Or we grant the authority to make rules, and then those rules are reviewed by this committee. I'm a little concerned that you're already far down the road in left field doing something completely different, now coming to us and saying, oh, by the way, this old stuff, just void it for us because we don't want it anymore. We've got something else which we aren't showing you that is what we're doing, and we think we have the authority to do it. That's all kinds of red flags for me. So.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, let me continue with that. Representative Koppelman, I certainly understand what you're saying. I get that. In the legislation, though, as provided in legislation, there is a requirement, legislative requirement, for school districts to participate in a school improvement process, which Advanced Ed does provide within that authority and within the Advanced Ed process. They do, and schools are required then to meet the obligation for being in a school improvement process. And so there may be, and we believe there is, then authority already in statute, perhaps, that supports Advanced Ed as not only the accrediting agency, but also the school improvement process. I believe that Advanced Ed is working with regional education associations to accredit regional education associations across the state.
We should get rid of Chairman.
Representative Koppelman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got our statute in front of us now. 15.102.11, which is the one you referred to, Mr. Marthaler, says this. The superintendent of public instruction may adopt rules governing the accreditation of public and non-public schools. Any rule adopted under this section must incorporate measures of student achievement and bear a direct relationship to improving student achievement. But you are saying we've done this without adopting rules and we think we're fine. I mean, it seems to me the statute clearly says if you want to do this, you need to do it through the adoption of rules. Instead, you're coming to us saying, we're at our own rules because we've got our own thing going over here, and we're just fine. Don't worry about it. I don't think that's legal. Would you care to comment?
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize that was a question.
Well,
is there a question at the end?
Yeah. I said, would you care to comment? Do you, are you reading something different than what I... You referred to that section. I just read it. It says adopt rules.
Representative Koppelman, I don't disagree with what you're saying. But we do believe beyond that section, obviously we do have the authority to adopt rules. We're asking that these rules, existing rules, because they're obsolete, that they be repealed, and because through other authority, maybe I cited the wrong authority, but through authority that we believe the state superintendent has, we have adopted Advanced Ed as the school improvement accrediting agency in North Dakota.
So retired, or what?
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Mayfire, wouldn't it, just following up on Representative Koppelman's line of inquiry, wouldn't it be a pretty simple matter just at the time that you're doing this to also have brought to us a new proposed rule that simply says that the Department of Public Instruction hereby adopts the advanced ed system as its accrediting preference? I mean, it doesn't have to be a full, you know, many pages long set of rules, but simply by reference, you could adopt that, and that way legislators would know what's going on, the public would know what's going on, parents of students would be able to find it in the rules. So, you know, I don't know that this would be a huge burden, but I think that Representative Koppelman is on the right track to say that there needs to be something in the public record other than just develop. I mean, everybody puts everything on websites now, but in terms of finding what the rules are, this is where the rules should be. Maybe that's the same question we just asked you, but, you know, how hard would it be to do that?
Senator Triplett, that would not be difficult at all. And we can certainly, should you hold this over, we can certainly bring that to you. If that's appropriate, if that's where the committee would like us to go, we can certainly do that. And it would not be a huge burden to do that.
Representative Silverdale, and then Representative Schatz, and then Representative Schneider.
Mr. Chairman, and I think Representative Koppelman answered my question. So North Dakota Century Code 15.10-11 does not specifically mean advanced ed. That was my question.
Representative Schatz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Bob, I noticed in your testimony you said this determination was based on the recommendation of stakeholders and approved by the state superintendent. And when you said stakeholders, you only mentioned what I consider to be administrators. I didn't hear anything about school board, you know, presidents. Parents are the number one stakeholder in this whole process, as far as I can see, and parents groups. At least I say legislators might be stakeholders in this process. But, you know, so I mean, when you make changes like this, and to me, the primary stakeholder, parents, aren't included, isn't that a flawed process then?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Schatz, I do know that there were others beyond administrators on that committee. I don't recall specifically if parents representing parent groups were there. I do believe the School Boards Association, I think the North Dakota Council of Education Leaders, Indy United. Specifically, I don't recall parents.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, while you're naming unions, and I don't think they represent the parents or the children. And when I see class size, student evaluation, personal pupil, personal services, counseling and guidance services, and all of these different things being replaced with something that I can't put my hands on and look at, red flags go up again. So, Mr. Chairman, if there's a way to delay this, I would be in favor of proposing that.
There's a couple more questions, but there's certainly a way to delay it. Representative Schneider.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mathaler, I do think there is a really good website on this that shows the parent involvement survey in the process itself and shows that they're sensitive to that, and the delay to incorporate the language that was discussed by Senator Triplett would give us a chance to kind of review that too. But on that website, it indicates that 235 entities are accredited under that system already. And I'm curious if you know how many others then would be seeking accreditation or or not be included in that list.
Representative, are you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, are you speaking of just school districts?
And when you enter the schools that are accredited in North Dakota, 235 entities come up. I haven't obviously had an extended chance to view whether there are things out on that list that would not fall under that definition. But.
Members of the committee, Representative and Mr. Chairman, schools and or school districts or by building can seek advanced ed accreditation. So I would have to review the list as well to see. I can tell you that we believe that all schools will seek accreditation through advanced ed.
Senator Klein.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and just following up on Representative Schneider's question, Bob, I heard you earlier when the question was asked, are all schools accredited, and you looked at Gwen, and yeah, they are. And then you also, I heard you say something about a five-year process. Are we going to see schools not be accredited then under the new rules that are maybe going to be more stringent because we're using a more regional sort of look at it? Or, you know, I guess I'm going, where I'm going is, I represent a lot of small school districts. Because of the new rules, are we going to be forced, are we forcing their hand?
Senator, members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, what we're asking schools, what schools are asked to do through advanced ed is to enter into a continuous school improvement process, meet certain established standards of instructional quality, of environment, you know, school culture, administration. But to specifically answer your question, I would hesitate to say that there would be schools that, there may be some, but there would be a real minimal number of schools that might not achieve accreditation through the advanced ed process. And when schools are, when the external visits are made and they go through the five-year cycle, if there are areas that a school is coming up short on, they certainly have opportunity to work on that for a year to you know, correct whatever the action might be. So,
Senator Triplett.
Mr. Chairman, I think my next question is for Ms. Marbach. Thank you. In your earlier testimony, you referenced both this concept of the school's self-assessment and that they make their own sort of decisions about, if I understood you correctly, the pace at which they're going to attempt improvement. But then you also said a few sentences later that there are very rigorous benchmarks, and those two concepts seem a little bit in conflict. So if you have a school that really doesn't want to improve very well, and so it doesn't want to put the resources in, maybe simply doesn't have the resources to because of their property tax base or whatever, that we maybe our formula isn't quite in the shape that we would like it to be, that everyone has the equitable and adequate resources. So they set themselves on a course to improve very, very slowly, but yet they manage to keep meeting those. How does that square against the very rigorous benchmarks?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, Triplett, members of the committee. In the continuous education process, this is a local process through advanced ed, and they decide how they're going to make improvements for student achievement based on data from test scores, surveys from students, teachers, parents, stakeholders in the community, school board members, so forth. With that information, with that data, they decide what their needs are to improve student achievement. They set their plan. Now, for example, if they've had a site visit and they have given what they're going to do and they have not made any progress, the accreditation agency, Advanced Ed, indicates that they are pretty much on hold for accreditation. So, or they're put in a different class of accreditation, lower, how do I put it? A lower class of accreditation. They need improvement to get full accreditation. And so then they go into the next year and they see if they've made gains to get full accreditation. Now, if they go for a certain amount of years, they're not accredited at all. If Advanced Ed does not see improvement in their student achievement. Does that answer your question?
No, because it doesn't address the second part of it, which is that there are very rigorous benchmarks.
Right. The very rigorous benchmarks are, you will achieve accreditation at this point with what you indicated that your district or school needs.
If I may continue, there really are no actual benchmarks. I mean, it's only everything is benchmarked against the stated goals of the
individual. Yes, yes.
And so if a particular group of children have the misfortune of living in a place where the school administrators have low expectations, then they could go their whole 10 or 12 years, hopefully 12, 13 years through the school system, and really that school doesn't improve much at all because they have lackluster administrators who see a tiny bit of improvement as being adequate.
Mr. Chairman, Senior Chairman, Managing Committee, I'm assuming that could happen. I've not seen it. Because we've not been through this process long enough to even address that. What Advanced Ed Accreditation, their goals and their benchmarks are to prevent that from happening.
Community, I don't want to spend another hour and get to exactly the same point where I know we're going to be. So, you know, it's my recommendation that we hold this over till the next meeting. The department, we expect the department to furnish our legal counsel. What authority you're basing on that you're essentially circumventing the administrative rules process on this. We can have our attorneys send you some questions, but I would entertain a motion to delay this repeal until the next meeting.
So moved.
Second.
Motion by Representative Schott, second by Representative Silvernagle. Discussion? Representative Koppelman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I certainly support the motion. I'm not sure this is kind of an unusual animal because we're not reviewing existing rules and holding them over the same way we normally would, but I don't know. I think just not acting as if the motion would cause us to not do. I think we're sending the message. I do have a quick question, if you don't mind, because I think we came up with another.
Great.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Final question.
Ms. Marbeck, how does approval or certification of approval of schools differ from accreditation, if it does?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Koppelman, members of the committee, it does. Approval is tied to money.
Thank you.
Yes.
I know you could go into a lot more detail, but in the chairman's interest in brevity, I think that answers it. My point, Mr. Chairman, is that the council just pointed out a different section of code which deals with approval of schools, and that's two pages. Hmm. The question dealing with accreditation, the only statutory reference we can find, clearly says that can only be done through rule. And so the other thing is, if we adopt, information as well, if, as Senator Triplett suggested, we adopt the Advanced Ed model by reference, we can do that. But if we adopt something by reference in administrative rule, it freezes it in time. You can't just say, we're going to do whatever this says, whenever it says it, forever. In other words, it has to be a specific reference to the 2015 document or something like that. And you can do it by reference, but then if it ever changes, you have to go through the promulgation process again to amend it into administrative rules. But to even do that, I don't think we can do that as part of this voiding that you're asking for of the old rule. I think you have to promulgate a rule adopting this other entity, as whether by reference or whether in full written form. just my understanding.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Koppelman, thank you for that. That is above my pay grade, but I take it with me.
Mm-hmm. All in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carried. You will hear from our attorneys. Or if there's any of the committee that has specifics that they want to address, please talk to Vanette or John so that they're in the letter so we know what's going on. Let us see if we can move quickly through the oil and gas division.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Richter, did you distribute my testimony? Evidently not. Okay.
Chairman and committee members, my name is Bruce Hicks. I'm the Assistant Director of the Oil and Gas Division. We're before you today requesting an extension from rulemaking under House Bill 1358, which was just approved by the 64th Assembly. The bill required bonding on underground pipelines. The bill also requires us to adopt necessary administrative rules on pipelines after a report is done by the Energy and Environmental Research Center in Grand Forks. That report is due to us and yourselves by December 1st. Under the statute, section 283207, it indicates that the rules must be adopted within 9 months after the effective date of the statutory change. The change in Bill 1358 was an emergency on the bill, so it was effective April 20th of 2015, and that's 3.5 months earlier than typically you would see on most bills, which would be effective usually on August 1st, unless they have some taxes or something associated with them. So what we're asking is additional time to review that EERC report so we can look at the monitoring methods and pipeline composition, spill frequency, and burial depth that they are going to be studying, and hopefully use this information to come up with better bonding requirements. Now, we do have a lot of our pipelines already bonded. If they're associated with a well or facility, they are bonded. These would go beyond that. This would be bonding also from central tank batteries all the way to a point where the pressure was increased and the PSC would take over those pipelines. It would also go from the sales point on a gas meter on a well all the way to the gas plant. And we would be considering bonding on those. So approximately a third to a half of those pipelines were already bonded. But we don't want to jump into something and come up with some rules that don't make any sense or that nobody can live with. And I have attached a timetable for adopting the pipeline rules. If we get the report as required on December 1st, it will give us a couple months to go in and do the rulemaking. We have already initiated that process. The Industrial Commission wanted us to go ahead and start that rulemaking internally just so we had an idea of how we were going to go about this. We have started that process already. We don't want to prolong when these rules will become effective, but we want to make sure we give ourselves enough time to go through all the comments and make sure we have good rules in place. The Industrial Commission meeting on February of 2016 would be when we would bring those proposed rules to the Commission. Hopefully they would accept those. They may send us back and say, we don't like these, come back next month with some better ones. We anticipate in April having a rules hearing. We anticipate a lot of comments on this, and hopefully we'll have real good rules out there, and there won't be a lot of comments, but negatively anyway, and hopefully in June we would come to the Industrial Commission and request
additional changes pursuant to what comments we have, and they would accept those. We would then go through the Attorney General's request, or requirement, I should say, to approve the rules and their legality, and we don't know how long he might take for that. Typically, it's right around a month. And then if we meet the August 8th deadline for filing these with the Legislative Council, the rules would become effective on January 1st of 2017. We are shooting for October 1st of 2016, but again, we don't want to paint ourselves in the corner. We want to have a little flexibility. We've already started the process, so we're trying to get on this as soon as we can. But we think we're going to learn a lot of good information from the study that's ongoing right now. We have met several times with EERC, and they're apprising us of how they are progressing. But we look forward to that report. So we are requesting an extension to January 1st of 2017. We are just barely in that quartile there, as you can see on the timeline for August 8th. If we filed that 5 or 6 days earlier, we would meet the other deadline of October 1st, 2016, of when the rules would become effective, and that's what we're shooting for.
Any questions? Senator Klank?
Mr. Chairman, I move for the extension.
A second?
Mr. Chairman, I would second, just because it's so refreshing to hear someone say we don't want rules that are confusing or hard to live with.
I was thinking the same thing, Representative Koppelman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I don't think I've ever seen this extension to up to a year. Typically, it's always been, you know, a three-month extension. I guess I don't know. I guess I've never seen an extension that would extend out to a year. Is this something unusual, or?
I would like to address that.
You may go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Banning, thank you for that question, because like I indicated, these rules were effective on an emergency clause, but they did say that the report had to be done on December 1st. So right away, we're already setting almost 6 months behind the typical rulemaking. And I didn't want to come in and ask for your forgiveness and say, you know, 9 months down the road now, we come in with these rules. I wanted to ask for permission to do that. But this is really what is tying to this, is that study. If that study didn't have to be done, then we could do this, and we might be coming in for only a couple months extension. But that study really pushes us off into 2017, and we're hoping that it doesn't go that far. I know 2017 sounds like a long ways out there. We are shooting for October 1st of 2016. But the rulemaking process itself is pretty lengthy.
Mr. Chairman, if I may continue.
You may continue.
Would it be possible to have them come back within a six-month period and give us an update as to where they're at, or how things are going in the process? And
Mr. Chairman and Representative Bing, we could do this like updates to the committee. We could do it by email if you would like. If you want us to come before you, it might cause a lot of confusion to a lot of different people that are looking at the rulemaking for pipelines.
I think
but we could certainly send it to Von Ett or who you.
I think an email would suffice. Yeah.
Right. We could certainly do that.
But this committee is a lot better at giving permission than it is forgiveness, too. I want you to know that. So, is there any further discussion?
I'm here then.
All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Oh.
Sorry, Senator Tippett.
Too late.
Too late.
I'll ask.
Opposed? Motion carried.
Thank you very much.
Julie, the only thing between the chairman getting this committee done on the time slated on the agenda is you.
Chairman, I'd be happy to shortcut this and say all the things that you asked me is
required. No.
That's true. All right. In that case, I'll hand out some stuff for you.
Thank you.
I think we have them. It's two different ones we should have, correct? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Julie Lee. I'm an attorney with the Department of Human Services, and we're here today to request two extensions. The first one is for rules governing payments to licensed community paramedics, advanced emergency medical technicians, and emergency medical technicians for health and human services, as required by 2015 Senate Bill Number 2043. We understand that the rules that have an August 1st effective date should be adopted by May 1st of the following year. To adopt the rules required under Senate Bill 2043, however, the department needs to convene stakeholders, research what other state Medicaid programs are covering, secure input and direction from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and analyze any impact of the department's health enterprise Medicaid management information system. With the implementation of MMIS scheduled for October 5th of 2015, the staff needed to draft the rules and to develop the program resulting from the rules are dedicated to system implementation and post-implementation efforts. Additionally, the impact to the health enterprise MMIS could not be addressed until after implementation. If the extension is granted, the department does intend to adopt rules by January 1st of 2017. That's the first request. You want me to do them both and then go for questions, or you want questions separately? The second request is the extension to adopt administrative rules governing the enrollment of licensed marriage and family therapists as of January 1, 2016 to provide services to recipients of medical assistance. The department will begin enrolling LMFTs in January of 2016. However, we are not able to prepare corresponding administrative rule changes within 9 months of the effective date of Senate Bill 2046. When the department implements limitations on services, we research what other state Medicaid programs are allowing for coverage and what, if any, limitations or exclusions they include. We also research what other third-party payers allow for coverage and include for limitations. Finally, as part of including coverage, including any limitations in the Medicaid state plan, the department is required to provide the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services with information about how we establish the limits and how we will guarantee access to services within the limits imposed. This information will need to be submitted to CMS no later than March 31st of 2016, and due to the amount of research we need to conduct before we can identify the changes we need to make to the rules, the department is not able to complete the research and develop coverage limitations for rule changes by May 1. If the extension is granted, again, the department intends to adopt the rules by January 1 of 2017.
Are there any questions? Seeing none, somebody want to make a motion to allow the extensions?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
Representative Boucher. Discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carried. Committee, the only other that I have is our next meeting is December 7th, which is a little earlier in the month than normal, but a number of you are involved with CSG and NCSL and some other things that are going on at that time, so that is why we set it December 7th. We sent this to you in June, but I was just going to remind you that their next meeting is December 7th. Anything else for the good of the order? We are adjourned.